Okay, in your outlines, what you want to be looking at is still chart number five. Chart number five, it says events of the middle of the tribulation. Here again, not everything all listed in this chart is within the book of Revelation. It also includes things coming from other prophecies in the Hebrew Bible. But we'll cover those that are within Revelation. You can turn now to Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11. Some of the things are in chapter 11, and one of the first of these things is just in the first two verses. Verse 1, there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and one said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. And the court which is outside the temple, leave it out and measure it not, has been given unto the Gentiles, and all the city shall they tread under foot 42 months. What happens here is the fact that the temple compound is now taken over by the Gentiles. And they control the temple compound for 42 months, which is equivalent to 3.5 years, the second half of the tribulation. Now, what we know for certain from Bible prophecy is that the Jewish temple will be rebuilt, will be functioning by the middle of the 7-year tribulation. And we know for biblical certainty it has to be built sometime before the tribulation starts, but we do not have enough information to know when before the tribulation or within the first half that it will be built. There are two options. It may be built in the first half of the tribulation. It may be rebuilt even before the tribulation starts. We cannot make it more exact than that based upon what the Bible reveals. About the middle of the tribulation, the temple is functioning. And then there is a sudden Gentile takeover of the temple compound, which will occur in the middle of the tribulation, which sets the stage for an event called elsewhere, the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation. Let me summarize certain other passages that deal with this. One passage is Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. Which records the event that will trigger the tribulation, which will be the signing of the 7-year covenant. But at the midpoint, there'll be the breaking of the covenant. It'll be marked by a forced cessation of the sacrificial system. The sacrificial system with the Mosaic won't be resumed because the tribulation temple is built by Orthodox Jews that do not accept Yeshua, Jesus to be the Messiah. And so like here in Revelation 11, verse 1 and 2, at the midpoint, there is a forced cessation of the sacrificial system marking the breaking of that 7-year covenant. The second passage is Daniel chapter 12, verse 11, Daniel 12, 11, the abomination of desolation, first mentioned in Daniel 9, 27, will last exactly for 1,290 days. Now, Daniel 9:27 does not specify exactly what the abomination is, but the word is frequently used in connection with idolatry. But Daniel chapter 12:11 points out that the abomination in the temple will last for exactly 1,290 days. Now, keep in mind the second half of the tribulation is exactly 1,260 days. And so the abomination will be allowed to continue for an additional 90 days beyond the end of the second half of the tribulation. Again, it says nothing about exactly what it is, but then, again, the word is often applied to images. A third passage would be 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4. 2 Thess 2, verse 3 and 4. Before that, Matthew 24, verse 15. Matthew 24, verse 15. The abomination of desolation will be assigned to Jewish people living in the land to flee the land. The present Jewish state that has been a fulfillment of specific prophecies of a regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. But the Jewish state as it now exists will collapse at the midpoint of the tribulation. And the signal for the Jewish people is when they see the abomination of desolation in the holy place. That's a sign for them to leave the country, escape, flee as fast as they can without a single second to lose. And Matthew gives some illustrations. If anyone is on the housetop for one reason or another, he must not come down off the roof and go inside the house to take any possessions, but as soon as his foot touches the ground, they must flee from the land. Or if they happen to be plowing in the field and hear of this event, they must not go back to the living quarters to take even a coat. They must flee from where they've been plowing as quick as they can. Because for the first time, Israel faces not merely regional or national anti-Semitism, but worldwide anti-Semitism. And the abomination of desolation will now signal Satan's last attempt to annihilate the Jews once and for all, for reasons we'll discuss a bit later tonight when we get to chapter 12 of Revelation. But Matthew 24:15 does not exactly specify what the abomination is, except they'll be erected in the Jewish temple. What it is involves two things, and the first element is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, 2 Thess 2, verse 3 and 4. And the first stage is that the Antichrist will seat himself in the temple and declare himself to be God Almighty and call upon the whole world to worship him as God. And we'll see also in chapter 13, they must, if they won't accept him as God, they must signify it by taking his mark of 666. But prophetically, he will not stay in Jerusalem. He will move to Babylon, which will be his political and economic world capital. And so the second stage we'll see in Revelation 13, verses 11 through 15. Revelation 13, 11 through 15, we'll see that later tonight. When an image is made of the Antichrist, it becomes a living image. They'll be set up in the temple. This image remained there for 1,290 days before it is finally removed. And so verses 1 and 2 tied together certain elements of it revealed in the Hebrew Bible. Now the next segment is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 through 13. Concerning the two witnesses. The timing of the ministry is given in verse 3. Now again, it focuses on events of the middle, and in the middle of tribulation they will die. But before they die, they have a ministry that's allotted 1,260 days. And these 1,260 days, again, equal to 3.5 years, and they'll have a ministry for the first half of the tribulation. The ministry will be at the same time as the 144,000 Jews, but they are geographically separated. The 144,000 Jews will be a worldwide ministry, but the work of these two witnesses will be geographically limited to the city of Jerusalem. Then verse 4 provides their identity. And notice the phrase, these are the two olive trees, for the definite article, and also two lampstands. What you learned about the lampstands in the first three chapters is that each church is represented by a lampstand. But now these two individual witnesses within the tribulation are represented by two lampstands, which emphasizes their call to be a witness and to present what people need to believe for salvation. So that much we already know from within the book of Revelation. What about the two olive trees? It has a definite article, the two olive trees, specifically two olive trees. But no olive trees have been mentioned in the whole book of Revelation previously, because he's falling back on a vision that was given to Zechariah the prophet in Zechariah chapter 4. Verses 1 through 14, Zechariah chapter 4, verses 1 through 14. In the verses 1 through 10, what Zechariah sees is the vision of a seven-branch lampstand, which symbolized Israel. And much of the vision he understands because of previous revelation, but one element he does not understand. So you have a seven-branch, I only have five fingers, but pretend there's seven. That's a seven-branch menorah, seven-branch lampstand representing Israel, like the lampstand that was in the tabernacle and temple. On each side of the lampstand is an olive tree. So you have two olive trees. And there's a pipe that empties olive oil into a large bowl over the lampstand. And to each, from the bowl, to each of the individual lamps, there are seven smaller ducts. For a total of 49. Seven to each one for a total of 49 ducts. And the one common element in all vision is olive oil. From the source, the olive tree, the two pipes, the bowl, the 49 ducts, and into the seven lamps. And the oil is a common symbol to the Holy Spirit. And that passage even specifies that in verse 6. Notice, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. So what Zechariah sees is Israel as a saved nation, filled with the Holy Spirit, finally fulfilling its calling of Exodus chapter 19, verse 5 and 6, to be the oil of Goyim, the light to the Gentiles. But the source of the oil are the two olive trees, and that's the part of the vision he does not understand. So verse 11, 12, and 13 raises the question, what are these two olive trees that empty the oil in the pipes and the bowl and the ducts into the lamps? And verse 14 is given a very cryptic answer. These are the two anointed ones that stand before the Lord of the whole earth. These are the two anointed ones to stand before the Lord of the whole earth. How much he understood from what he was told, because the very cryptic answer, we're not sure. But what we do know now from this passage is that those two olive trees in Zechariah 11 represents the two witnesses who have an active ministry in the first half of the tribulation, limited to Jerusalem. Now, for some reason, throughout the history of the prophetic word and how it was being taught, people for some reason have felt this need to have to be Old Testament characters. There's nothing in there to indicate that. There's no reason to make that assumption. Everybody else in the book is future. Why make the two witnesses historical characters? And so people have given two basic possibilities. One possibility is that these two witnesses are Elijah and Enoch. And why Elijah and Enoch? Because these two men never died. And Hebrews teaches, the book of Hebrews teaches, it's appointed men once to die, after this the judgment. So for this reason, these two men must come and die at this point of time. But the principle you find in the book of Hebrews is a general principle, not an absolute rule. Generally speaking, it's appointed unto people only to die once, and then the judgment. But there are two types of exceptions. Some people die twice. The people resurrected by Elijah and Elisha died again a second time. The ones even the Messiah resurrected, like Lazarus, died again later. Is a second way that there are exceptions is that some people don't die because of the special grace of God. Take, for example, the living saints at the time of the rapture. And Paul says, I tell you a mystery. we all shall not die. We all shall not die. So if the Hebrews passage is an absolute rule, what that means is that all of us who may be living in time of rapture are going to have to come back and die at some later time. But the exact promise is we're not going to die. The living saints at that time will not die. And so there's no reason to make them Elijah and Enoch. I might point out that in Hebrews 11, verse 5, it says Enoch was translated, using the same verse, the same Greek word, as you find in 1 Corinthians 15. Translation means mortality puts on immortality, corruption puts on incorruption, and so that the body is glorified. So therefore, being translated, he cannot die. As Elijah went to heaven, he would have gone in the same state in 1 Corinthians 15:50. Now, another possibility Peter presented is that these two will be Elijah and Moses. Why Moses and Elijah? Because these two men were with Jesus at the Mount of Transfiguration. So because they were at the Mount of Transfiguration, therefore they have to be the two witnesses. That's faulty logic. That's a faulty logic. True, Moses and Elijah were on the Mount of Transfiguration. It doesn't mean they have to be the two witnesses. Now, it's true Elijah will come back. And that's in Malachi chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. Malachi 4, verse 5 and 6, Elijah will need to come back. He's coming for a special ministry to Israel. This doesn't mean he's got to be one of these two witnesses. So it's best to take them futuristically as everybody else in this book. These are going to be two Jewish men that God, that will be living in that point of time that God will choose to focus in the prophetic field as being the two prophets, the two witnesses. Another reason people give is for Moses and Elijah because similarity of miracles. Like Moses, they turn water to blood. Like Elijah, they call fire from heaven, which is what two witnesses do as well. So yes, Moses did turn into water into blood. Yes, Elijah called fire from heaven. But where in the Bible does it teach that these two men now own a monopoly on those miracles? Can't God use somebody else to do the same miracles as well? God used Elijah to raise someone from the dead. He also used Elisha to raise someone from the dead. So these are just assumptions. And so there's no reason to assume these historical people but will be futuristic people living that time. Now verses 5 and 6 give us the nature of their ministry. In verse 5, they're able to kill by fire coming out of heaven. And in verse 6, they're able to cause all kinds of plagues for those who are trying to kill them. And because the allotment of this ministry is 1,260 days, that means they cannot die before the allotment is complete. They cannot die, the allotment is complete. However, after 3.5 years, the allotment is complete. And in verses 7 through 10, we have the account of the death of the two witnesses. In verse 7, they're killed. And occurs, notice, after the Antichrist arises up out of the abyss. What that means, we'll see a bit later tonight in chapter 13. But the beast that comes up out of the abyss is not going to accomplish what everybody else failed to do, to kill the two witnesses. And that'll provide another reason why people begin to worship him. Because all who previously failed and died, this one person is able to succeed. And the whole world is very happy that these two men are now dead. And notice in verses 8 and 9, they lie dead in the streets of Jerusalem, unburied. And the whole world is able to observe it. I remember reading all their critics on passages like this that says, this shows you cannot take it literally because how is it possible for the whole world to see one thing in Jerusalem? What else before CNN? before Fox News. Now there's no question that you can do this. So that criticism has passed away in the course of time. And in verse 10, notice they are so happy that people are throwing parties. And they observe a counterfeit Christmas observance because they're exchanging gifts with each other. They give Christmas gifts. They're so happy that these two men are dead. But then the sudden rejoicing around the world comes to an end in verses 11 and 12. Where in the sight of all, people can see that these two men suddenly are resurrected back to life and then ascend up into heaven. And the resurrection and the ascension of these two witnesses leads to the four results you see in verse 13. Number one, a great earthquake will hit the city. Secondly, 7,000 residents of the city will die. Thirdly, it'll destroy one-tenth of the city. But then notice the fourth point. The rest were frightened and gave glory to the God of heaven. The rest were frightened and gave glory to the God of heaven. So what happens in the middle of the tribulation, we'll see the salvation of the Jews of Jerusalem. Not the whole nation just yet. But the Jews of Jerusalem will come to faith and be saved in the middle of the seven-year tribulation period. And that will begin a process that we shall see later in the week that will bring about the salvation of all Israel, which in turn fulfills the prerequisite to the second coming. It will bring in the Messianic kingdom. But the Jews of Jerusalem are going to be saved at the midpoint of the 7 years, which is why in Matthew 24, verses 15 to 22, Jesus gives a warning sign. When you see the abomination of desolation, flee the country. Flee somewhere outside the land. Because of what happens here, they become believers and are ready to listen to the admonition Messiah gave about 2,000 years ago. And so we're going to see a process that will ultimately lead to Israel's national salvation. And the next thing in chapter 11 comprises verses 14 through 19, where we finally come to the seventh trumpet. Again, to summarize, you have the seven seal judgments of chapter 6. The first six judgments were individual judgments. But the seventh seal was not a judgment, single judgment, but it contained the seven trumpet judgments. And as we saw yesterday, each of the first six trumpet judgments were individual judgments, one after the other. But now the seven trumpet will not be an individual judgment. It will contain the seven bowl judgments that will then be expounded upon in chapters 15 and 16. So in verse 14, we now come to the third bowl judgment, which is the seventh trumpet. And as the result of the seventh trumpet is Messiah will now inherit the kingdom of the world. In verse 15, he will now inherit the kingdom of the world. And what the book says about the seventh trumpet, he'll also say about the seven bowl judgments of chapters 15 and 16. Again, what he says about the seventh trumpet will also be true of the seven bowl judgments. And as we shall see as we proceed. But again, shows that the seventh trumpet judgment contains the seven bowl judgments. Notice also in verse 15, the word kingdom is singular, because at this point you have the one world emperor, the counterfeit son, the Antichrist, and now the kingdom of the world in which he was a counterfeit ruler would not be taken over by the true son. And the final judgment is further detailed in verses 16 through 18. To destroy them that destroyed the earth. To destroy them that destroyed the earth. And this will be also stated to be the result of the bowl judgments in chapters 15 and 16. So again, this shows the seventh trumpet judgment will contain the seven bowl judgments. And every judgment, remember, has a prelude in heaven. And the prelude in heaven to the bowl judgments is given in one verse, verse 19. And thus the focus especially is on about the temple in heaven. The temple in heaven. We get to chapter 15 as they're ready to go with the seven bowl judgments. We'll see again in more detail of the prelude in heaven before the actual bowl judgments begin to be poured out. Now, verse 19, just to clarify, there was opened in the temple of God that's in heaven, not the earthly one, but the heavenly one. And there was seen in his temple the Ark of his covenant. This is not the Ark of the covenant that Moses made. Because what Moses made was a copy of what he saw up in heaven. And so Moses made a copy of what was in heaven, that included the whole tabernacle system, but also the Ark of the covenant. The Ark of the covenant that John sees here is not the one made by Moses. What happened to that one? Nobody knows. It never survived after the Babylonian destruction. But this one is the heavenly one, which was the original one. As we now come to chapters 12, 13, and 14, here we have what we mentioned in our first session, the law of recurrence. Before, he will now continue with the chronological sequence, which will pick up again in chapter 15. So what he ends with here in chapter 11, he'll continue with chapter 15. And what he now deals with, our fun law of recurrence, has given us some more details about the events of the midpoint of the tribulation that continue into the second half. And chapter 12 focuses on one theme, and the theme of chapter 12 is Israel in the tribulation. Israel in the tribulation. As he has often done before, and will do so again, he also does here. Going back to the Hebrew Bible to provide some background material, and he begins with a historical review in chapter 12, verses 1 through 5. And in verses 1 and 2, he sees the first sign in the heavens. What he sees in this sign is a woman dressed with the sun, moon, and 12 stars. All this goes back to Joseph's dream in Genesis 37, verses 9 through 11. Genesis 37, verses 9 through 11. From there we learn that the sun represents Jacob. The moon represents Rachel, who also in the Hebrew Bible became the symbol of Jewish motherhood. And the 12 stars represent the 12 sons of Jacob, who in turn fathered the 12 tribes of Israel. So this woman throughout this chapter is the people of Israel, the Jewish people. Now again, the sun represents Jacob, and the evidence of this is Isaiah 40, verse 27. Isaiah 40, verse 27, chapter 49, verse 5, 49:5. And Jeremiah 30, verse 10, Jeremiah 30, 10. The moon represents Rachel, who represents the Jewish motherhood in Jeremiah 31, verse 15. Jeremiah 31, 15, which is quoted in Matthew 2, verse 18, Matthew 2, 18. And the 12 stars are the 12 sons of Jacob in Joseph's dream that were fathered the 12 tribes of Israel. So throughout this whole chapter, this one woman represents the Jewish people, the people of Israel. But in verse 3, at a certain point of history, which is just before the first coming, just before the birth of the Messiah. Because in verse 3, what he sees is, he then sees a second sign in heaven, the great dragon. He'll let us know later that this represents Satan. This has seven heads and 10 horns. And so this dragon represents the fourth Gentile empire from Daniel chapter 2 and 7. Daniel 2 and 7 represents the fourth Gentile empire in its final form. The final form is going to be the Antichrist. But in this part section, it's inspired by Satan. And notice in verse 4, that he gathered one-third of all the stars, all the angels that fell with him. To be in and around the land of Israel just before the first coming occurs. What's good about this verse in particular is why, as you read through the whole history of the Hebrew Bible, because about 4,000 years of human history, you'll find references to demons here and there, but not very dominant, not very prominent. You come into the Gospels and there's a sudden explosion of demonic activity. Everywhere the Messiah goes, he's confronted by demons, sometimes by a legion of demons. When you get past the Gospels in the book of Acts, keep in mind the book of Acts is the longest book in the New Testament. It gives about 30 years of early church history. Demons are mentioned how often? Only four times. Only four times. And these verses now help to explain why, because normally Satan has all his demons spread throughout the world doing his bidding. But the Messiah was about to come to earth, and then while he was on earth, he brought all the demons together to be either within or around the land of Israel to try to thwart the purpose of the first coming, to try to keep the accomplishment of the first coming from being accomplished. And that's why you have this explosion of demonic activity in the Gospels. You don't have that before or after. So keep in mind, what is normative is not what we see in the Gospels. That was abnormal because the Messiah was here in the land of Israel. The normal is what you see before the Gospels and what you see after the Gospels. The activity is there, but it's not as stringent or as explosive as it was within the Gospels. But what he explains here is not only the attempt to destroy the child when the child is born, which in the first attempt at that was the slaughter of the babes of Bethlehem. However, throughout his public ministry, you see many attempts to have him killed, either at the wrong time, before or after the specific Passover where he was scheduled to die, or in the wrong manner, like by sword or by stoning. Because if the Messiah died at any other time than that Passover, in any other way than by crucifixion, there would have been no atonement. Not merely his death that was essential for the atonement, that was all that was necessary. Then when he died, we could have been killed as a two-year-old in Bethlehem with the other two-year-olds, and that would have been sufficient. But that would be insufficient. His death had to come at a specific point of time in a specific way. So attempts are made throughout the Gospels to kill him at the wrong time, before or after Passover, or in the wrong manner, like by sword or by stoning. Each of those attempts are filled with the same phrase, his hour was not yet come. His hour was not yet come. Ultimately, his hour did come. And in verse 5, the child ascends into heaven, awaiting, ultimately, for Israel's response. We've given us these five verses, which summarizes the whole life of the Messiah from just before his birth until his ascension. In verse 6, he picks it up with where the previous passage led off, which was the midpoint of tribulation. And in verse 6, notice, Israel is fleeing. It says she flees into the wilderness. She flees to a specific place prepared for her, and there she hides for 3.5 years. It's the same flight of Israel from the land described in Matthew 24, verses 15 to 22. Matthew 24, verses 15 to 22. So there'll be a place for Israel to flee to. Now, while verse 6 explains Israel fleeing the land at the midpoint of tribulation, doesn't say why. The why comes now in verses 7 through 12. And verse 7 through 12 describes a war between holy angels and fallen angels that will take place in the atmosphere where Satan now dwells. So verse 7 says, there was war in heaven, Mark and his angels going forth to war with the dragon, and the dragon warred and his angels, they prevailed not, neither was the place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he was called the devil and Satan, leader of the whole world, he was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. Well, Satan lives today, is in the atmospheric heavens, lives in the air. You see this in Ephesians 2:2. Ephesians 2:2, he's the prince of the powers of the air. Also Ephesians 6:12. See Ephesians 6:12. He resides in the heavenly places. That's where he lives. He has access, free access to two localities. First of all, he can go up into heaven. And he does so frequently for one purpose, and that is to serve as the accuser of the brethren. So again, when believers sin and live in sin without confession, eventually Satan will go up and accuse that sinner of that sin. Also, but that free access into heaven will not be removed with this angelic war. And Satan will be cast down to the earth. He'll be confined to the earth for the second half of the tribulation. And this confinement will continue for the second half of the tribulation. It will continue for 3.5 years. Now, those are the different names he's given in verses 8 and 9. The great dragon, emphasizing his fierceness, Satan's fierceness. Secondly, he's called the old serpent, which points back to the Garden of Eden, where he used the serpent to cause man to fall. And the tribulation is a judgment for human sin. Thirdly, he's called the devil, which means accuser. He's the accuser of the brethren. Fourthly, he's called Satan or Satan, which means adversary, and he's the adversary of God. And fifthly, the deceiver. He's a master counterfeiter. And although he's actually the angel of this darkness, he reveals himself as an angel of light. He's not the angel of light, but he reveals himself and shows himself to be that way. Now, Satan's confinement to the earth will lead to two results. The first one is in verse 10, 11, and the first part of verse 12, that not the Satan's access into heaven is removed, there's rejoicing in heaven. And never will the saints in heaven ever again have to hear an accusation against one for whom Messiah died. And so verse 12 says, therefore rejoice, O heavens, ye that dwell in them. But the second result is for the earth. It's quite the opposite. Verse 12 continues, woe for the earth and for the sea, because the devil has gone down unto you, knowing he had great wrath, knowing what he had but a short time. The second result is woe for the earth, because once Satan is confined to the earth, he knows his time is short. He knows there's only 1,260 days left before the second coming. And knowing his time is short, he is full of wrath, very angry. So verse 6, Israel flees the land. Verses 7 through 12, it's because Satan has been cast down to the earth. And now notice how verses 12 and 13 bring together the thoughts of verse 6 and verse 12. So looking at verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man-child. They were given to the woman the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness unto a place where she is nourished for a time and times and a half a time from the face of the serpent. So the reason Israel's fleeing is because she's now facing the wrath of Satan. And the wrath of Satan is now focused on her for the purpose of trying to destroy her. So verse 13 picks up on where verse 6 left off. In verse 14, she flees into the wilderness specifically to flee satanic persecution. And notice in this verse, she'll be fleeing and hiding for 3.5 years, the second half of the tribulation, and she'll be held by the wings of the eagle. As I mentioned, a popular writer uses this verse to show when the Jews have to flee, they'll have the help of the American Air Force. But again, as we saw from Exodus 19, verse, I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you myself. It's an idiom for a successful escape after being pursued because of divine intervention. So in the Exodus account, the Jews were being pursued by the Egyptians. God intervened, they were able to escape. By the same token here, the Jews are being pursued by the army of the Antichrist, but it'll be divine intervention. As the army pursued the Jews, notice what God has done before. In the book of Numbers, he'll do again. The earth will simply swallow up the pursuing army. I don't know if the earth's going to burp, but at least it's going to swallow this mass army pursuing the Jewish people. And so in verse 15, the initial attempt to destroy the Jews by a military invasion in the midpoint of the tribulation will fail. And verse 16 further emphasizes the help of the earth in swallowing the enemy army. And now verse 17, the dragon waxed wroth with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed to keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. Notice he now begins an all-out war against the woman in general. His goal is to try to annihilate every Jew in the world before the second coming. But he especially targets, notice, the Messianic Jews of that future period, those that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. And why pick on the Messianics? Because they have the gospel, they believe the gospel, and they're the ones to be sharing the gospel with the others who have not yet come to faith. And Satan does not want the gospel to get out to the Jewish people because of the prerequisite to the second coming. And so he will war against the Jews in general, but the Messianic Jews in particular. Now, why is he warring against the Jews? Why is he organizing a worldwide Nazi-like structure to try to wipe out the Jews once and for all? That lies in clearly understanding the precondition to the second coming. And the precondition is Israel's national salvation. I'll give you some verses to write down. We don't have time to expand upon them. But you can mark down, for example, Leviticus chapter 26, verses 40 through 42. Leviticus 26, verses 40 through 42. Jeremiah 3, verses 11 through 18. Jeremiah 3, 11 through 18. Hosea chapter 5, verse 15 through chapter 6, verse 3. Hosea 5, 15 through chapter 6, verse 3. Then you have Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10 through chapter 13, verse 1. Zechariah 12, 10 to 13, 1. And also Matthew 23, verses 37 to 39. Matthew 23, 37 to 39. Now, the Gospel of Matthew chapter 12 is when the Jewish leaders reject him to be the Messiah and ascribe his unique signs and wonders to the work of Beelzebub, the prince of demons. At that point, Jesus announced to the leaders of that day and the generation of that day that they were now under a divine judgment that is now inerrable, a judgment that will come in the year 70 with Roman destruction of the city and the temple and the forced dispersion of the Jews throughout the world. And so to this day, the Jews are dispersed. There are still more Jews outside the land than inside the land. However, it's going to stay that way until Israel becomes a believing nation. And what they must do is to fulfill the preconditioned second coming, which involves two things. Number one, they must confess their sin of rejecting his messiahship. And when they make that confession, they will use the words of Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. Isaiah 53 is not merely a prophecy of the crucifixion, which it is, but rather, as you read, you notice that's Israel confessing their sin of not recognizing him when he first came. Oh, we like sheep have gone astray. Oh, we have turned away, the Lord laid upon him the iniquity of all, and so on. And so we're going to be dealing with just to confess the national sin, and then the second thing that must happen, they must plead for him to return, to mourn for him as one mourns for only son. And the words of the pleading is return, you'll find in Isaiah 64, Psalm 79, and Psalm 80. This is one of the key differences between the rapture of the church and the second coming for Israel. The rapture of the church has no preconditions whatsoever. It can happen any moment of time as part of God's program for the body of the Messiah, for the church. But the second coming has this one precondition. And the second coming is part of God's program for Israel. Not the church, but for Israel. The rapture is for the church. The second coming is for Israel. But for him to return, they must do those two things. And part of the purpose of the tribulation is to bring them to the point they'll finally begin to fulfill those two things, to bring about a second coming. Later on, as we get to the second coming passages, which will be sometime tomorrow, we'll get further into this. But this is as much as I can say for now, from based upon what chapter 12 is teaching. Okay, let's move on to chapter 13. Now, chapter 12 focused on the counterfeit father, Satan. Now, verses 1 through 10 of chapter 13 will focus on the counterfeit son, the Antichrist, and then verses 11 through 17 will focus on the counterfeit spirit, the false prophet. So verses 1 through 10, you have the beast from the sea. The beast from the sea, which means the sea, when speaks as a symbol, symbolizes the Gentile world. And here he builds on what Daniel already saw in Daniel 2 and more so in Daniel 7, but I don't have time in this highlights version to actually deal with the details. But again, what you find in verses 1 and 2 is the final form of the fourth Gentile empire, which should be the empire of the Antichrist. He has 10 horns, which represent the 10 kingdoms that he'll have power over, and the 7 heads represent 7 sequential kings. I don't have time to detail this, but he is the 7th head. It's a sequential. The last head will be the Antichrist head. The point of verse 2 is that the three previous empires left their influence on the fourth empire. So it mentions the body of a leopard, and the leopard represented the Hellenistic empire in Daniel 7. So this is the Hellenistic influences on the fourth Gentile empire. The bear represented the Medo-Persian empire, so these are the Medo-Persian influences. And the lion represented the Babylonian empire. Babylonian influence. And this verse helps to explain what prophesied in Daniel 7, verse 12. Daniel 7, verse 12. That the three empires before the fourth one, their dominion came to an end, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Their dominion, their authority ended, but they still left an influence on the fourth empire. And in verses 3 through 8, you have the worship of the Antichrist. Now notice in verse 3 that one of his heads, this would be the 7th head, was smitten unto death, but the death stroke was healed. And the way some people have interpreted this, it means that the Antichrist will fake a death. After faking his death, he will fake a resurrection, and that will cause people to worship him. Let's look back to another passage we mentioned in the first night, Revelation chapter 5, and notice the same idiom is used of the true son. Revelation chapter 5, verse 6. I saw in the midst of the throne, in the midst of all living creatures, in the midst of the elders, a lamb standing as though it had been slain. As though it had been slain. that the Gospels are clear that he really did die a real death. And by normal human experience, he should have remained dead. But Stalin was very much alive because of his resurrection. So the phrase, as though it had been slain, used of the true son here, represents it's an idiom for a resurrected individual. What is said of the true son, back to chapter 13, is now said of the counterfeit son. As though it had been smitten unto death, but the death stroke was healed. The same terminology. What happens in the middle of tribulation, this is part of Daniel's prophecy, not Revelation, but in the middle of tribulation, this is Daniel 11, verses 40 through 45, Daniel 11, verses 40 through 45, the Antichrist will declare war on the 10 kings. In the course of that war, he'll be killed. And when Satan is cast down to the earth, then Satan raises him back to life. And so the idiom applied to the true son in chapter 5 is applied to the Antichrist here in chapter 13. It's an idiom for a resurrected individual, and Satan raises him back to life. And that's going to cause, in verse 3, the whole world wondered after the beast. Not just Europe, but the whole world will do so. Now, just as we worship the Father by means of the Son, notice the same thing in the counterfeit system, verse 4. Satan is now worshipped through the Antichrist. And so the counterfeit God the Father is now worshipped by means of the worship of the counterfeit God the Son. In verses 5 to 7, go on to explain some of his activities. Number one, in verse 5, he'll speak great things. Secondly, in verse 5, he'll be able to continue for 3.5 years. So absolute authority, worldwide absolute authority he'll have, but it will last only for the second half of the tribulation. In verse 6, he blasphemes against heaven and all who will live in heaven. And fourthly, in verse 7, he will conquer. There'll be wars and conquerings against two groups. Notice, against the saints in verse 7. He'll overcome them, and also against the nations in verse 7. So by means of all these conquests, he will gain world political authority, but also in verse 8 will gain all religious authority. All unbelievers will worship him, those now written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Well, Lamb's Book of Life is, we'll discuss, if not tomorrow, then on Thursday. But I'll just leave it here for now. Those whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And then there's the warning of verses 9 and 10, where God now gives a warning. Men will be treated as you treat others. So those who offer the sword will die by the sword, and so on and so on. And this fact is a word of comfort for the saints living in the middle and the second half of the tribulation, and to encourage them to exercise patient endurance. Exercise patient endurance. Now we come to the second beast in this chapter, who is the third member of the counterfeit Trinity, the beast from the earth in chapter 13, verses 11 through 18. In verse 11, we have the rise of the second beast. This one is lamb-like, which gives him a religious character. He speaks like a dragon. We already know is Satan, so he represents a religious system, but is actually a satanic agent. Elsewhere in the book, he'll be referred to as the false prophet. And we'll see this three different times as we move through the book. Now, verses 12 to 15 describe his activities as the activities of the counterfeit Holy Spirit. So in verse 12, for example, he exercises all the authority of the first beast. So just as the true Son is co-equal with the true Spirit, by the same token, the counterfeit Son will be equal to the counterfeit Spirit and vice versa. And just as the true Spirit goes what draws men to worship the true Son, in the second part of verse 12, the counterfeit spirit causes people to worship the counterfeit sun. Now the faster the counterfeit, the spirit arrived with miracles, signs, and wonders, and now the counterfeit spirit does the same in verses 13 and 14. Miracles, signs, and wonders. The second part of verse 14 and verse 15, he makes an image of the first beast, makes an image of the Antichrist. And becomes, and he then gives the image life, that this image can both speak and to kill. And this is the image that will represent the second stage of the abomination of desolation. It will be erected within the Holy of Holies of the Tribulation Temple, able to remain there in Daniel 12, verse 11, for 1,290 days. People sometimes assume that Satan cannot produce life and therefore make the assumption that this cannot be literally true. That's an assumption that is not biblically verified. For example, many of the supernatural signs and wonders that Moses did were repeated by the Egyptian magicians, including, for example, changing water into blood. And so the Egyptian magicians did the same sign that Moses did. At that point, the Egyptians did not need any more blood. But the principle is, while Satan can duplicate a divine miracle, he cannot undo a divine miracle. And when Moses took his stick, threw in the ground, it became a living snake. The Egyptian magicians took their rods, threw in the ground, also became living snakes. Where did their power come from? Not God, but Satan. And then Moses brought up frogs from the earth that began to infest every habitation in Egypt except where the Jewish people lived. And the Egyptian magicians duplicated the same miracle. They created even more frogs. But at that point, the Egyptians did not need any more frogs. I suspect when they saw their magicians making more frogs, they're ready to croak themselves. But again, a principle, he can duplicate a divine miracle, not undo one. So what we see happening here is an image turning into life, able to speak and to kill. Now the true spirit came, and those of us who believe are sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise that guarantees our eternal security. But the Egyptian... Not the Egyptian, but here we have the counterfeit spirit also creating a seal or a mark. Now the mark that we receive is invisible. It's visible to God, it's not visible to humans. But this becomes here a visible sign. And this is now in chapter 13, verses 16 to 18. And so, a counterfeit seal is issued in the people who accept the Antichrist as God. In verse 16, have the option of either putting it on their right hand, or for those who are more zealous, putting it on their foreheads. And taking the mark becomes the means of submission to accepting the Antichrist as God. The means of submission of accepting the Antichrist as God. In verse 17, the purpose of the taking the mark is simply to have the right to continue making the living. It's not a banking system. It's not a credit system. It's not a unified monetary system. In the credit system, everybody has to have a different number. So if you have a Visa card and I have a Visa card, my number is going to be different than your number. Here, everybody gets the same number. Everyone gets the same number. And the purpose of receiving this mark is only to have the right to continue working for a living, continuing maintaining your business, and so on. It will serve similarly as what happened when Poland got conquered by the Nazis and everybody had to receive an ID The Gentile Poles received an ID with a swastika on it. The Jews did not receive a swastika on their ID kits. They had to leave their homes, went to the ghetto, they lost their jobs and everything else. By the same token, only those who accept the Antichrist as God and show it visibly by taking his mark will be have the right to continue making a living. Now what he does, he goes on to provide five things about the sign that lets us interpret what it means. This is in verse 7 and 18, the five clues. Number one, the name of the beast. Secondly, the number of his name. Thirdly, the number of the beast. Fourthly, the number of a man. And fifthly, that number is 666. Now, this is what he's dealing with. The Hebrew alphabet has 22 letters. And in classical Hebrew, every letter was also a number. In modern Hebrew, we have a separate system for letters and numbers. But in classical Hebrew, every letter was also a number. And the first 10 letters were sequences by ones. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then skips by tens to 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, down by hundreds, 100, 200, 300, 400. So every Hebrew letter has numerical value. Every word in Hebrew letters has numerical value. And everybody's name in using the Hebrew alphabet will have a numerical value. The numerical value of the Antichrist name, we don't know what's going to be, but whatever his name is, it will equal in Hebrew characters to the amount of 666. So I can take anybody's name and give a numerical value. I take a person here. The first name is equal to 20. The second name is equal to 303. The total is 323. So this means Edith Crabb does not qualify to be the Antichrist. So if any of you want to find out if you're a possible candidate for this office, just see me after the meetings. I'd be happy to give a numerical value of your name. But that is the emphasis of this specific passage. Now moving into chapter 14, what we have here is mid-tribulational announcements. Mid-trib announcements and the three purposes for these mid-trib announcements. Number one, to predict the failure of the program of the counterfeit Trinity. And the program of the counterfeit Trinity, again, is to annihilate every Jew before the time runs out in order to avoid the second coming. But now this in these seven proclamations, it will show the failure to reach that goal. A second purpose, to announce the results of the bold judgments of chapters 15 and 16, which will be the most severe judgments. To announce the most results of the most severe judgments, the bold judgments. But then thirdly, to give a word of encouragement and comfort the saints that will be living at this in the second half of the tribulation. As hard as it was for the saints of the first half, those of the second half will have a much greater difficulty. Now the first proclamation is in chapter 14, verses 1 through 5, where he sees the 144,000 he first saw back in chapter 7, being with the Messiah in the Messianic Kingdom. What he sees in this period is the Messianic Kingdom, where the Messiah will rule, and the 144,000 will be with him. And that shows the 144,000 Jews will survive the tribulation, and therefore Satan's program of total Jewish annihilation is going to fail. Furthermore, they're referred to as the first fruits. The first fruits are more to come later. That the first fruits of Israel's national salvation. And 3.5 years later, after their salvation in Jerusalem, all Israel will come to faith. In verses 2 and 3 describe the song that the 144,000 will be singing. And in verses 4 and 5, we learn some more about the nature and the character of these 144,000. Notice the five things he points out. Number one, there'll be virgins, because the nature of the tribulation simply is not conducive to marrying and having children. Secondly, they'll be following the Messiah continually. Thirdly, they're the first fruits. And again, first fruits means the first and more to come later. And the rest of Israel will be the more to come later. Fourthly, they're without lie, no internal defilement. And fifthly, without blemish, no external defilement. The second proclamation is in verse 6 and 7. Here we have the final call to the world to accept the gospel in light of what's been happening in chapter 13, to make the final choice between the true son and the counterfeit son. And if they choose the true son, they'll have to reject the mark of the beast. If they choose to follow the counterfeit son, they'll be taking the mark of the beast. But the call is to make the final choice between the true son and the counterfeit son. In verse 8, we have the third proclamation, which is the proclamation of the fall of political Babylon. That'll be detailed in chapter 18, which we should get to tomorrow. And the fourth proclamation in verses 9 through 12 makes a key point that once a person is chosen to take the mark of the beast, he's reached the point of no return. To take the mark is to once and for all accept the Antichrist as their God. And there'll be no opportunity for them to be saved once the mark is taken. Now, this is what Paul refers to in 2 Thessalonians 2. So keep your finger in Revelation and turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Look at verse 8, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. Then shall be revealed the lawless one, whom the Lord Jesus shall slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to nothing by the manifestation of his coming, even he whose coming is according to the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceit of unrighteousness for them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God sends them a working of error, that they should believe a lie, that all might be judged who believe not the truth, but pleasure in unrighteousness. Often people pull the verse out of context and assume he's talking about that those who hear the gospel before the rapture cannot be saved after the rapture. But he's not dealing with the rapture, he's dealing with the revelation of the man of sin. And the point is that God will send the people a spirit of delusion. And the spirit of delusion will be given to those who were given the opportunity to believe in the true Son. They chose not to believe in the true Son, and then chose to believe in the counterfeit Son. And for that reason, they'll be given the spirit of delusion to believe a lie. And the lie is the Antichrist claimed to be God. That's the context in this passage. So go back to Revelation 14. We should note that just as we see here in 2 Thessalonians 2, nobody will take the mark out of ignorance. Nobody will take the mark of ignorance before they make a decision on taking the mark. Everybody would have heard the gospel at least twice, if not more. But from the 144,000 among the Gentiles, among the Jews, the two witnesses, and then the angelic voice that proclaimed the gospel in the language of everyone that speaks that language in the world. So they all heard the gospel at least twice, both by natural human beings, supernatural, the angelic voice in midair. So if they choose then to still follow the Antichrist, there is the point of no return. They'll now be assigned for two key judgments. Number one, they'll drink of the wine of the wrath of God, and drinking the wine of the wrath of God will be the bold judgments of Revelation chapters 15 and 16. And then secondly, they'll be destined for the lake of fire. And verse 12 says, this is the patience of the saints. Now the fifth proclamation is in verse 13, a special blessing to the saints who are martyred during the second half of the tribulation, because it's so much more severe. The sixth proclamation is in verses 14 through 16. The sixth proclamation is a proclamation of reaping. And reaping is a common symbol of salvation, which shows that even with what's happening in the second half of the tribulation, with the mark of the beast and everything else, still people be coming to salvation in the second half of the tribulation. Then the seventh proclamation will be in verses 17 through 20, which is a proclamation of the treading of the grapes, a symbol of judgment. And the grapes are gathered for the wrath of God. The wrath of God in particular will be the bowl judgments of chapters 15 and 16. The special place where this judgment of wrath be poured out, it's noticed it's without the city. Without the city will be the city of Jerusalem. And that's where the Valley of Kidron is. And the part of the Valley of Kidron, that parallels the east wall of Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives, is called the Valley of Jehoshaphat, the Valley of Judgment. And their blood will begin to flow, a multitude of blood that will be as high as 4 feet and extend for flowing to 200 miles from the Valley of Jehoshaphat all the way down to the Gulf of Eilat, or the Gulf of Aqaba. All of this would be a result of the Armageddon campaign. We'll cover that in more detail tomorrow night. Now go to your next chart, which is chart number 6, the second half of the tribulation. Here he picks up where he left off at the end of chapter 11. Let's go back to chapter 11 just for a second. The seventh trumpet was blown. And in verse 19, there was opened the temple of God, which is in heaven. The temple is the focus of out of which the bowl judgments come. And they'll see in his temple the Ark of the Covenant and so on and so on. And this one verse of 11:19 is not given more elaboration in chapter 15, verse 1 through chapter 16, verse 1. Chapter 15, verse 1 through chapter 16, verse 1, that's the prelude in heaven before the pouring out of the bowl judgments. So verse 1 of chapter 15, there are seven angels that have the seven bowl judgments. And notice what he says in that verse. This will complete the wrath of God. This will complete the wrath of God. And so what was said earlier about the seventh trumpet now is said about the seven bowl judgments, which again shows that the seventh trumpet contained the seven bowl judgments. Verses 2 through 4 describe the martyred saints of the second half of the tribulation. In verse 2, they conquered in the spiritual warfare. And in verses 3 and 4, they'll be singing two songs. First of all, the Song of Moses. And the Song of Moses can refer to one of the two songs we have in the Torah, in the five books of Moses. It might be the song in Exodus chapter 15, verses 1 through 18. Exodus 15, verses 1 through 18, or it could be the Song of Moses in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 1 through 43, Deuteronomy 32, verses 1 through 43. But in both situations, these are two songs of victory. They'll also be singing in verse 3 and verse 4, the Song of the Lamb, and the words are found in these verses. Then in verses 5 through 8, you have the preparation of the pouring out of the seven bowls. And once again, notice the mention of the temple in heaven, picking up from where 11:19 left off. So in verses 5 and 6, the seven angels come forth. In verse 7, the same seven angels are given the seven bowls. And then in verse 8, you have the brightness of the Shekinah glory, so no one can enter the temple until the Shekinah glory is fully entered, which will come at the end of the bowl judgments. In chapter 16, verse 1, the command is to pour out the bowl judgments. What we're going to do is just deal with the first five of the bowl judgments. Bowl judgments 6 and 7 concern the beginning and the end of Armageddon. So we're going to begin our study tomorrow night with all and survey all eight stages of Armageddon. So we're going to go as far as the first five bowl judgments. And the first bowl judgment is in verse 2, where a cancerous ulcer breaks out on the skin of those who take the mark. It may even break out on the very spot where the mark of the beast was taken. And this is fulfillment of Revelation 11, Revelation 14, verses 9 through 11, 14, 9 through 11. The second bowl judgment is in verse 3. Now, with the second trumpet judgment destroyed one-third of the world's salt waters, and now the rest of the world's salt waters is also destroyed. In verses 4 through 7, we have the third bowl judgment. In the third trumpet judgment, one-third of the freshwater supply was destroyed, and now the remainder of freshwater supply is destroyed as far as springs and rivers are concerned, meaning in other types like wells or cisterns, water will survive. And that leads to two declarations. In verse 5 and 6, a declaration of the angel of the waters. And in verse 7, the declaration of the altar, both emphasizing God's righteousness in rendering judgment upon humanity. The fourth bowl judgment is in verses 8 and 9. In the fourth trumpet judgment, one-third of the sun failed to give light during the day, and one-third of the moon's stars failed to provide light at night. But this time it affects the sun in such a way that it increases the temperature of the sun tremendously. In verse 9, causing people to be scorched, and yet they, instead of coming to God, they blaspheme God for what they suffer. And the fifth bowl judgment will be in verses 10, 11. We have the fourth of the five blackouts. This one is towards the end of the second half. But the kind of blackout that causes pain is similar to the kind of blackout that fell upon the Egyptians among the 10 plagues in Exodus chapter 10, verses 21 through 23, Exodus 10, 21 to 23. And yet men in verse 11 continue to blaspheme God. Okay, we'll stop there and we shall deal with Armageddon starting tomorrow night. There's a book there called Israelology, subtitled The Missing Link in Systematic Theology. This was my doctoral dissertation at New York University. And what this does is deal with the first few chapters, deals with three different schools of replacement theology. It shows you how far they can develop Israelology, but it's always falling far short of what the Bible teaches. And then we'll deal with attraction and dispensationalism, which has done the best with Israelology, but still misses a lot of areas. And so the last chapter was my actual contribution in this dissertation. This will deal a lot, and you can just read chapter one, for example, which gives you the way we define our terms. You can skip the in-between if you're wanting to write to chapter 10, which is the positive presentation. You'll hear about all the covenants that God made with Israel, all these elements about God's promises and so on. So this is a good book as a resource. I have one written question, so I'll take that one first. What are the fundamental mistakes that preterists or partial make when interpreting Revelation? Not just Revelation, but also the prophecy of the Bible. Well, preterism means, basically, you have partial preterists and full preterists. A partial preterist believes all prophecies of the Bible have not already been fulfilled except for the second coming. All prophecies have already been fulfilled except for the second coming. And a full preterist says even the second coming was fulfilled already. What they have to do is resort, number one, to an allegorical method of interpreting the Bible. Allegorical. Because they have to simply allegorize this massive amount of material and say, well, you can't take it literally. And so they impose a lot of meanings to these passages that would not be normally understood if you just take it as it reads. So a key element that's a differential is the hermeneutic, the science of interpretation. Also, as part of the system, they fail to make a consistent distinction of Israel and the church. And what they believe is that you cannot interpret and understand the Old Testament on its own. You have to interpret it on the basis of the New Testament. So the New Testament has to interpret the Old Testament for you. Which means until the New Testament came around, all the possibilities of what the Old Testament may have meant had to be wrong, because God did not reveal what the true meaning was until the New Testament time came. But it's an assumption that people make. You have to understand the old by the new. No, you have to understand the new by the old. Because the old, you have all of these things that the Bible talks about Israel, about prophecies, about kingdom, and so on. And so whatever else comes to the New Testament, it can and does provide new additional information. But it cannot undo was already revealed in the Old Testament. It cannot render those promises null and void. They stand. Now, what does the New Testament add? And that's the proper way. This week, the Bible was given to us in the chronological sequence. And if we had to wait till the New Testament comes around, then we had no way to clearly understand the Old Testament. That's a fallacious kind of reasoning. So it's a bad hermeneutic, and that you have to avoid so much literal interpretation, allegorize so many things that don't need to be allegorized. Like Ezekiel 13:39. Well, that was already fulfilled. Where? In the book of Esther. If you read the book of Esther, you won't find any similarity with Ezekiel 13:39. It does not exist. But they just simply allegorize that they force Ezekiel 38 into the book of Esther, fulfilled in the book of Esther. And that's a faulty system of hermeneutics. And often they'll say, well, and I quote them in Israelology, that the terms Israel and the church are just used interchangeably. So I went through the Bible, to the New Testament. How many times is Israel used? Exactly 73 times. And it's never used of the church. It's never used of Gentile believers. It's only used of ethnic Jews, sometimes Jews in general, sometimes the remnant of Israel, the Jewish believers in particular, was never used of the church. And so they make these broad statements, and they never even try to prove it, which is why I wrote that dissertation to begin with. I'll say more things, because we're going to hit the kingdom passage, if not tomorrow, then the last day. And so I'll say more about these things later on, but this is just the introduction. Question? Over here.
Israel will flee. Will they go to Petra? And how many
that? Petra will be the place where they'll flee to, and also the place where the second coming will occur. But Petra is a modern name for the Hebrew name Bozra, B-O-Z-R-A-H. The fact that's what the remnant is hiding is in Micah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13. Micah 2, 12 and 13. It's also where the second coming will come initially. And that's in Isaiah chapter 34, verses 1 through 7. Isaiah 34, 1 through 7. Even more graphic, chapter 63, verses 1 through 6. Chapter 63, verses 1 through 6. Yes. Because that's what it says. People assume, but if you look at this, it says in Zechariah chapter 14, his feet will stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. But verses 1 and 2, you get all the Gentile armies attacking Jerusalem. Verse 3 then says, then shall the Lord go and fight against those nations. And when the fighting is over, he then stands upon the Mount of Olives. And even earlier in Zechariah 12, verse 7, of also describing all these armies coming together against Israel, it says, the Lord will save the tents of Judah first before he rescues the inhabitants of Jerusalem. There's your chronology. The fact that Jews living in tents shows they're now living in their permanent homes because they have to flee, and what they flee to would be the city of Bozra. And God, and he'll save the tents of Judah first. And once he rescues them, they'll come to Jerusalem to rescue the Jews of Jerusalem. And then he stands upon the Mount of Olives. So it's good to take note of the passages. Question? Any other questions?
What's the significance of the beast, the red dragon? You have these three natural animals, and then you have this animal that doesn't have a normal description.
Yeah. Well, it first appears in Daniel chapter 7, where the first beast is lion-like, then the bear-like, then the leopard-like. But when you come to the fourth beast, it's nondescript. He cannot compare to any known animal. The first tree was like a lion, not really a lion, like a bear, not a real bear, like a leopard, a bear. And so what he just says it's an indescript beast. He cannot describe it. He can't compare it to anything except the seven heads, ten horns, and things of that nature. And then what closes it is Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, where he points out that this is the makeup of the fourth beast that has influences of the first three empires and things of that nature. He has seven heads, which are sequential. One follows the other. And the last stage would be the Antichrist head. This one smitten unto death, but his death stroke was healed. So the beast in Revelation becomes the final form of the fourth Gentile empire. Chapter 2, by the way, in Footsteps, gives you the outline of the times of Gentiles, just comparing Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Revelation 13, Revelation 17, brings it all together in different charts. The question here?
The song of the Lamb.
Yeah. Yeah, Revelation 17.
Yeah.
15. I'm at 15.
Three and four.
Yeah, the song starts with the word "Great and marvelous are your works."
Okay.
Okay, that's the song. Because it's a Jewish song, it'll be the minor key. Question?
Those who keep the commandments of God in 12:17, is that just a general description of Jews, or does it mean somehow that they got to go back to the Torah?
No, I think it's the first probably the commandments at that point would be the commandments of the Lord, the Messiah. They keep the law and the testimony of Jesus. So the Torah they're keeping is the Torah of Jesus, not the Torah of Moses. Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? Okay. We'll see you tomorrow night at Armageddon.